here for the next while. I'm going to be preaching through Genesis 37 through 50. I don't know what other speakers are sharing on, but that's what I have felt like the Lord has asked me to do. And in this, I guess you could call it a series, Genesis 38, if you have been reading along, is quite the chapter. And we're going to try and find some redemptive purposes to this chapter, but it's quite an interesting chapter. Has anyone ever seen the movie Les Mis? Yes, most of us, some of us. The opening scene in this movie shows a former convict looking for a place to sleep. His name is Jean Valjean. And after much searching for a place to rest, he finds a priest who's willing to open his home for some food and a place to sleep. And so while eating a meal with the priest and his wife, Jean Valjean notices the cutlery that he's eating this meal with, and it's made from pure silver or a lot of silver, and it's probably really expensive. And as he looks at his spoon, you can tell that it's foreshadowing something to come. And so he goes to sleep after the meal, and in the middle of the night, he wakes up from a dream and proceeds to pack his bag with all the silverware, stealing it from the priest. And in the middle of his act, the priest finds him, catches him in the middle of the act of stealing. And but Jean Valjean punches him and knocks him out and then runs away with all the cutlery. And the scene changes to the next morning where the authorities have found him and have brought him back to the priest with this bag of silver. And after questioning the priest says to the authorities, well, yes, I've given him this cutlery. But Jean, why didn't you take the silver candlesticks as well? They're worth 2,000 francs. And then the priest says, you promised to be a different man. Jean Valjean, you have been bought with a price. You are a new man, and now I give you back to God. One of the most moving scenes of the grace and mercy of God. Every time I see that scene, it just gives me shivers all over of what essentially God has done. He's bought us with a price, and he's extended his grace, his mercy and forgiveness to us. And from this encounter with the priest, Jean Valjean becomes an honorable, repentant, and dignified man. His life is forever changed by this encounter, this moment, and he has encountered the grace of God. As we continue our series on Joseph, we're going to see incredible grace and how God is continually working through his people with grace. A few weeks ago, we came to the end of chapter 37, and Joseph had been sold into slavery by his brothers, which in the ancient Near East would have been akin to essentially killing their brother, murdering their brother because it was stealing the life from Joseph. And Joseph's now on his way to Egypt because he's been sold to the Midianite slave traders or the traders, and he's been sold to Potiphar, the captain of the guard, essentially the chief of police in Egypt. And as we've gone through chapter 37 and parts of Genesis, we've seen the dysfunction over and over and over of the Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and how incredibly dysfunctional they are, yet God chooses to use a people who are broken, full of hatred, favoritism, jealousy, lying, and deceit, It's full on, it's like the latest soap opera, full of drama. And it's hardly Christian TV. Most of us would be probably quite hesitant to watch it if it was made into any sort of film. And now the focus turns in Genesis chapter 38. The focus turns from Joseph, who's kind of been the main character up until now, to another man named Judah. And you're probably thinking, if you've read Genesis 38 ever, you're probably thinking, okay, wait a minute. I thought we were in a series on Joseph. I thought this was about Joseph. What's going on here? Why are we talking about Judah and Tamar at this point? And some liberal scholars think Genesis 38 is just some interruption in the grand story of Genesis to perk up the reader's ears, to bring some excitement. If there hasn't already been enough excitement already, it's just some random story in the middle. And that couldn't be further from the truth. We will see God's grace woven all throughout this chapter and how God decides, how God brings about his plan of redemption to save a people, to save the world, essentially, and to save a people who are in desperately need of him. So why don't you turn in your Bibles to Genesis chapter 38. We're not going to read the entire chapter because I might not be invited back if I read it. Just kidding. Just kidding. There's just some interesting things in here. But we're going to read we'll start with the first five verses. And we begin to see Judah's downfall, Judah's sin. And so Genesis 38 says this. It happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned aside to a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. There Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. He took her and went into her, and she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. Yet again she bore a son, and she called his name Shelah. Judah was at Chezib when she bore him. So we see at the beginning of this chapter that Judah has gone down to Canaanite land. He's left his brothers. He's left his family. And maybe, you know, maybe he's sick and tired of the family drama. We don't necessarily know why he went down to this Canaanite territory. Maybe he couldn't face his father anymore for the things that he had done to Joseph in selling him into slavery. But he has no intentions of keeping the people of God, up until this point, what the people of God are, the family of Jacob. He has no intention of keeping that family together. He has no intention of continuing on the family name and staying within the Hebrew people. And Judah visits a friend of Adullam, Hiram the Canaanite. And this is very telling that he has a friend in the Canaanite people. And there, Judah takes a Canaanite wife. Now, if you know much about the biblical times and what the Hebrew people were to do and not to do, taking a Canaanite wife was a no-no. These were not a part of the people of God. They would essentially draw the people away from God. Now, Genesis 24 and Genesis 28, Abraham tells his servant to get a wife for his son, but he's not supposed to get it from the Canaanite people. And Genesis 28, same thing. Isaac forbids Jacob to take a Canaanite wife. These are not good people. And so they are supposed to stay away from the Canaanite people because they would bring corruption to the people of God. They were involved in idol worship. They were involved with worshiping false gods, grotesque worship practices. There was temple prostitution. And ultimately, they would bring destruction to the people of God. And so Judah is walking in something that he has been forbidden to do, and his grandfather and his great-grandfather have been forbidden to do. And it is clearly going to draw the people away from God. And so Judah's settled in the land of the pagan people. He's had three sons, we read here, from a Canaanite wife. And things aren't going too well. Judah has three sons, Onan, and Shelah. And we begin to see that Judah has fallen a long ways away from what God is requiring of him, of the Hebrew people. He's in desperate need for his eyes to be opened, and he's in desperate need of his eyes to be opened that he needs God. He needs to have an encounter with God. And by the end of Genesis chapter 38, we'll see that he does, but it's in a very unusual way. All right, so we continue on in Genesis 38, verses 6 through 12. And Judah takes a wife for his first son, and her name is Tamar. And she's also most likely, the text doesn't say, but she's most likely from the Canaanite people as well. Again, another no-no. And verse 7 in chapter 38 says, Judah's firstborn was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. We're not told what Ur's wickedness is, but it must have been pretty bad if the Lord is putting him to death. And then we see Onan, Judah's second son, fails to fulfill his brother-in-law duty, and the Lord puts him to death as well. He's evil in the sight of the Lord as well. Now, what is the duty of a brother-in-law? Well, if a man died, his brother was supposed to, and this would not be acceptable today, but it was acceptable in biblical times and even commanded by the Lord, that a brother-in-law was to fulfill his duty by giving the wife children and providing children for her. And this was actually for her protection. See, if you were a widow in that time, you were one of the furthest along in the food chain. You were at the bottom of the food chain. Things would not go well for you. You'd be extremely poor. And it just wouldn't be a great life. And so having children would allow you to one day be provided for by them. Your children would take care of you. It also would mean that your children would carry on the family line, the family lineage, which was extremely important in that time. And so Onan doesn't carry out his brother-in-law duties and is also put to death. I think the text shows us, even though Onan had interactions with Tamar, he made sure that she would not conceive and bear children. And so essentially what Onan was doing was taking advantage of Tamar in ways that he shouldn't, but not allowing her to conceive children. And so a very evil thing to do, incredibly humiliating for Tamar. And Onan was taking advantage of her and but not fulfilling his duty. And so the Lord takes his life as well. So Judah now is down to one son. He's got one son left. The first two have been killed by the Lord. This is not going too good for Judah. And he's probably thinking at this point, this Tamar lady is not bringing any, she's bad luck to the family. Things are not going good here. And so if I give her my last son, Shelah, it probably won't go good for him either. And so what Judah says is, he says, hey, Tamar, why don't you go back to your father and live with your father until my youngest son is old enough to fulfill his brother-in-law duties. And then at that time, I'll give him to you. Unknown to Tamar at this point, Judah really has no intention of giving his final son to Tamar. And so once again, he's lying and deceiving Tamar. And this is something that has haunted the Hebrew people, deception and lying. If you remember the kind of the overview of Genesis that I gave about a month ago, there's a lot of lying and deception going on in the family of God. And so in the course of time, Judah's wife dies, and Judah goes up to shear his sheep in Timnah. And we see Genesis chapter 38, 13 to 23, we now begin to see Tamar's scheme. And the scene shifts from Judah to Tamar. And she knows that by now she's kind of put two and two together that she's never going to have children. She's not gonna have Shelah as her husband. Judah's not gonna give her the final son, and so she creates a scheme. She's been strung along and taken advantage of for years, and now she's gonna come up with an idea she's going to come up with a plan that we're going to see here shortly. And she is concerned with the fact that she is a widow and she's going to need children that one day will provide for her. Otherwise, she's going to be completely without anything. She's also concerned with carrying on the family lineage of her husband, or her dead husband. And so, like I said, she devises a plan to trick Judah. And again, the lying and the trickery and the deceit come back to the people of God to haunt them. So she becomes aware that Judah is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. And Tamar, if you read in chapter 38, Tamar takes off her widow's clothes, and she puts on different clothes that would disguise her as a woman of the night, if you know what I mean. And she waits for Judah, her father-in-law, on the side of the road at the entrance to Enam. And ironically, Tamar is waiting for Judah at the entrance of Enam, which means the opening of the eyes. And Judah, at this point, is in desperate need of his eyes to be opened. I mean, he is completely deceived in his own life, his spiritual blindness that he's walking in, the fact that he has sinned over and over and over and tricked others. And his whole entire family is essentially taking advantage of Tamar. And the situation that he has gotten himself into is incredibly dysfunctional. And he is in desperate need of God. It's also ironic that Judah doesn't recognize his daughter-in-law at the entrance of Enam, because it means the opening of the eyes, and yet he doesn't see his very own daughter-in-law. And so trickery, like I've said, trickery and deceit have been ravaging the family for generations. It's just something that happens over and over and over again. Isaac has been deceived. Remember, Jacob dresses up like Esau to trick his father. And Jacob has now been deceived twice by going to his uncle Laban's, wants to marry Rachel, but gets tricked into marrying Leah. And now Judah is being deceived by his daughter-in-law. And Judah's true character emerges as he approaches the gates of Enam, because he turns aside to this woman of the night, which is his daughter-in-law. And so, he unknowingly is going to have interactions with his daughter-in-law, Tamar. He's a man who is driven by his desires at any cost. He has no sense of morality. This furthers the idea that the people of God should not be interacting with the Canaanite people because their sense of morality was incredibly low. I mean, they would visit temple prostitutes. They would do grotesque worship practices with their gods in their temples. And here we see Judah is doing the very same thing with Tamar. Unknowingly, it's Tamar. And so as Judah turns aside to be with Tamar, Tamar asks for payment. And Judah says, I'll give you a goat. And she's like, okay, well, you can give me a goat, but you don't have one right now, so I'm going to need like a deposit on that goat. And so Judah says, all right, well, I'll give you my cord, which is a piece of clothing. It's like a sash. And I'll give you my staff for walking and herding sheep. And I'll give you my signet, which is probably the most significant part. It is a stamp that would be used to mark his property. And so all three of these pieces are something that would signify his identity and his authority. And Judah's depravity continues. He's willing to give up his personal belongings, his very authority, in order to pay for his escapades. And so Judah takes Tamar, and surprise, surprise, she conceives. And seemingly, after she conceives, they go their separate ways. Judah goes back home after his sheep shearing time, and Judah gets his friend, the Adullamite, to bring the payment to Tamar. So he doesn't even take responsibility himself. He gets his friend to bring the payment of the goat to Tamar. And so he goes down and is looking for this prostitute, and she's nowhere to be found. And so he goes back to Judah and says, look, I looked for her, couldn't find her. And Judah's like, okay, all right, whatever, right? And it again furthers Judah's depravity, showing his colorful character by getting his friend to bring the payment, and then when that doesn't work out, he doesn't even really care. Oh, I tried to pay her, but whatever. And the story doesn't end there. It gets even better. In Genesis chapter 38, verses 24 through 26, we see there is a little bit of hope, I guess. But it gets worse before it gets better. 3 months later, it's found that Tamar is pregnant. And she's, it's being told to Judah that she has been immoral. And what does Judah do? Right, exactly. Judah protests and says, bring her out. We must burn her. Wow. Wow. Talk about a man of high character. In glaring fashion, we are introduced to Judah's horrible, horrifying double standard. Incredible double standard. He's willing to commit adultery. He's even willing to pay for it. And he's willing to pay for his sins and willing to let his own sin slide. But when when Tamar is found out, he wants judgment. There's got to be, she needs to be burned. And he's probably thinking, finally, I can get rid of this lady who's brought bad luck to my family. You know, something I think we so often do, we can identify with Judah, is that we downplay our own sin and we up the ante on everyone else's sin. Oh, I just did this one little thing. It's not that big of a deal. Oh, they did that very same thing? Oh, they need to be burned. You know, we downplay our own sin. We want mercy. We want grace. We want forgiveness for us, but we want judgment for everyone else. And so too it was with Judah. And the hypocrisy of our hearts is devastating at times. But the Bible is very clear that the judgment we pronounce on others, we will also be judged by that same standard. Jesus makes no bones about it in the Sermon on the Mount. Our hearts need the grace and mercy of God at such great lengths, don't they? As Tamar is being brought out to be burned, she's like, well, hold on a second here. I've got these three items, and if there's an individual in the crowd who can identify these items, that is the man who is the daddy. Things just got a little awkward. Sounds like a bad episode of the 90s show Maury. Anyone ever watched that daytime TV show, Maury? I'd be embarrassed to say that I've seen it, but it's essentially a talk show where they interview these people, and then, you know, this lady's pregnant, and who's the father, and they bring on they do paternity tests on live television, and it's like, Judah, you are the father. Oh, man. Don't go and Google that show, by the way. It's not worth your time. Yeah, no, don't worry about it. I won't tell you. No, it's called Maury. It's Maury. Yeah. So anyways, Judah is caught red-handed, and he says, in a moment of realization, he says, she is more righteous than I am. Since I did not give her my son, Shelah. So he realizes, I was supposed to give my last son to her to fulfill the righteous duty, the righteous act, but I did not do it. She is more righteous than I am. And Judah immediately understands why Tamar has gone to such great lengths to do what she had done, which wasn't okay either. Let's just get that straight. That wasn't a good decision either. But he, in a moment, he understands it was my sin that caused her to do the things that she did. She is more righteous than I am. And I believe in this moment, Judah has encountered God. Judah has been convicted that he is in desperate, desperate need. I mean, at this point, he wouldn't have known Jesus, but essentially, he needs help and lots of it. He needs a breakthrough in his life. He realizes his depravity and need for grace and mercy, and it is time for a breakthrough. In Genesis 38, 27 through 30, we've gone through this entire chapter. It is hard to read this chapter, but in the last three verses, we see incredible breakthrough and incredible hope. When the time came for Tamar to give birth, she gives birth to two sons, Perez and Zerah. I'm probably pronouncing both of those right. And again, they're fighting in the womb. And we've seen this before in Jacob and Esau fighting in the womb. These two are fighting in the womb again. And what is redemptive about giving birth to twins? How is this a breakthrough? You're probably thinking, well, there's not much. I mean, it's a father-in-law and a daughter-in-law. How is there going to be redemption here? How is there going to be breakthrough here? But remember, a few weeks ago, I brought up this idea of but God moments. But God, again, we see over and over where things are horrible, and then but God. And we see a but God moment right here. If you're familiar with the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew chapter 1, Perez and Tamar are both in that genealogy. And so from the line of Judah and Perez and Tamar, from those three, come salvation. Jesus, the Lion of Judah, Revelation 5:5, and the one of the elders said to me, weep no more, behold, the Lion of Judah, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, Jesus, the Root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals. The incredibly horrifying story of Judah and Tamar is miraculously used by God as an act of grace, an incredible act of grace to bring about the person of Jesus. God uses this whole situation to bring about his eternal plan of salvation, Jesus. And guess what, ironically, the name Perez means? It means breakthrough or breakout. And Jesus is the breakthrough. He is essentially the breakthrough. He is the one who is broken into Judah's life. And is going. We're going to see where he's going to bring change. Judah has come face to face with his need for God. He needs to be confronted with his sin and failure, and for God to mold him into the man that he needs him to be. And so through this whole process of Judah and Tamar and having twins, Jesus essentially comes about, and he is the ultimate breakthrough. And so at this point, you might be thinking, Randall, I thought you were doing a series on the life of Joseph. Why are we talking about Judah and Tamar? We are in a series on Joseph. However, remember when we started the series, I said, even the life of Joseph really isn't about Joseph. Does anyone remember me saying that? Yeah. Even the life of Joseph isn't actually about Joseph at all. It's actually about a faithful God being faithful to his promises, even though his people are completely unfaithful to him. They are completely broken. They are completely lost. And yet God is faithful to his promises. Genesis chapter 3, we were introduced to the snake crusher, the one who would crush the serpent's head. And this is that story of how God is bringing about his plan of redemption to bring about the person of Jesus, who will one day shower upon the world his grace through dying on the cross. And so we see God being faithful to his promises. Earlier this week, Becky was making supper, and I sat down at we have a little bar, I guess, on our counter. And I was sitting there, and she was making dinner, and I was talking with her, and I just took her through Genesis chapter 38. I just talked through the story, and she's cringing at times, and she's like, oh, stop, because I went into more detail than I did this morning. And it is an incredibly difficult story to talk about, to read about. And then at the end, I said, so what do you think is like the big takeaway of Genesis chapter 38? And without even skipping a beat, Becky said, well, of course, it's God uses incredibly broken people for his plans and purposes. Like, without a shadow of a doubt, God uses incredibly broken people by his grace. Judah and Tamar are both incredibly flawed individuals. They're actually both deserving of death for the things that they have done. Doesn't that remind you of us? We are deserving of death, but God. But God. Yeah, prostitution. Correct. We'll continue on. Yes, the things that people have done in these stories aren't necessarily righteous acts. However, God still uses them. We're not encouraging prostitution in this story or anything like that. In fact, the opposite. But so in this story, both Judah and Tamar are deserving of death, but God, in his grace and in his mercy, uses them, like I said, like I showed in the birth of the twins, and Perez essentially means breakthrough, and Jesus would come through in that way. And so they're both flawed individuals. And so I think an encouragement to us, this one encouragement to us this morning, is that we are all incredibly flawed. Maybe we haven't done the things that Judah and Tamar have done, but we are incredibly flawed human beings who are in need of the grace and mercy of God. And in his grace and mercy, he has made us new. He has taken our old man and crucified it, and he has made us new. And now we can live life and life to the fullest. I love what blogger Pedro Chung says. He says, this story of grace in Genesis could only be conceived by Yahweh. The way that God does things could only be conceived by him. That's why I love the song "You Are," where it said, you are perfect in all your ways. I was like, of course you are perfect in all your ways. Look what you've done. You've taken complete nonsense and used it for your plans and purposes, your glory. Judah is not a picture of moral purity. In fact, he's the exact opposite. He's lived a life in turmoil, brought on mainly by himself, selling his brother into slavery, leaving his family, moving to Canaanite land, marrying Canaanite woman, involved in all these different things. And this drama at times is unbearable. And Judah is blind to all of it. And he's caught in his own cycle of sin. And people, commentators have thought maybe one of the reasons why Judah left his family and moved to the Canaanite land was to get a fresh start. The problem with getting the fresh start is, Ian Duguid says it the best, the main hitch with the clean break approach is that you cannot make a clean break from yourself. Where you are, there you will be. And isn't that the truth? I mean, how many times have we in our life, I mean, I know I've done it. I'm like, I just need a change of scenery, or I just need this, an external circumstance to change, and then everything inside will change. And that's not the case. You make an external change, and the inward is still the same. And we need Jesus. We need an encounter with grace, an encounter with a person to bring that internal change. Isn't that what the gospel is? An encounter with Jesus, right? I love what Vodi Bauckham says. He says this, "For now, Judah is the epitome of salvation by grace alone." Judah is a picture of salvation by grace alone. Today, we need an encounter with God. We need an encounter with grace. We've probably all said yes to Jesus, but we still need him to transform us into the image of his son. We still need, at the end of Judah's life, we do see a little bit of a turnaround. He no longer... He fulfills, well, he says, he's convicted of his life, and he says, Tamar is more righteous than I. And from there on out, we will continue to see a change in his life because he's encountered God, and us too. We need that encounter to be transformed into the image of Jesus. And so the big takeaway, I think, this morning from Genesis chapter 38 is that God in his grace and mercy will use a broken people for his plans and purposes. So why don't we stand together and let's pray. Jesus, I thank you for Genesis chapter 38, even in its incredibly difficult scenarios, incredibly grotesque at times in what it's talking about. And God, I thank you, though, that at the end there is breakthrough. I thank you that you eventually brought about your plans and purposes for your glory and for our good, that by your grace we are saved, and by your grace we are transformed into the image of Jesus. And so this morning, God, I pray that like Judah, we would have an encounter with grace, we would have an encounter with Jesus, and that we would be continually formed into the image of Jesus. We pray this in your holy name. Amen. 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 All right.